You are listening to Paranormal Matters. I'm your host, Rick Fair. I'd like to welcome Susan Demeter, the author of The Cosmic Witch, to the first episode of Paranormal Matters. I'm the host, Rick Fair, and I'm really looking forward to today's discussion. The author of Cosmic Witch, Magic, Witchcraft, and the Supernatural, Susan brings the reader in what starts as a deeply personal journey, in which you, Susan, address early on as being quite instrumental to your growth. And you bring the readers through this very troubling at times journey, but also a journey that's filled with wonder. And I found as a useful anchor this quote that you had in chapter one, right at the very beginning, by Hazrat Inayat Khan, in which he states, "There can be no rebirth without a dark night of the soul, a total annihilation of all that you believed in and thought you were," end quote. As the book progresses, it blossoms from your journey in which you discuss the pain of divorce, being a single mother, a survivor of breast cancer, and then into this expansive quest, exploring the relationship between magic and science, disenchantment, the goddess mother, and the burning times in which tens of thousands of mostly women, but also some men and children, which you highlight, being executed for practicing witchcraft in medieval Europe, and in particular, where you're living now in northern Italy. This last topic, the burning times, is something that I'm curious to know a bit more of your thoughts about as we talk today. But as I read through the book, I couldn't help but wonder if Khan's words about a total annihilation of all that you believed, you thought you were, was actually part of this larger path that you were leading us, the readers, on when it came to the subject of witchcraft. So I'm just kind of curious, was that intentional? Was that your intention with this wonderful book? You wanted the readers to really revisit and perhaps call in this annihilation for all that we believed in?
In part, yes. That was part of the intention, was to just sort of shake up some common misconceptions about what it means to be a witch and witchcraft in general, outside of, you know, mainstream pop culture and how it's been portrayed in horror films and spooky books and such. Particularly now, as so many people are identifying as witches and pagans and that. So I certainly don't pretend to speak for everybody. And I address that in the book, that I kind of have my own path, as everybody does, but there are some basic misconceptions that, yeah, kind of needed to be annihilated, so to speak. You know, not in perhaps a trauma filled way as the dark night of the soul or those types of soul journeys, but yeah, certainly the intention was there, is to show that, you know, identifying as a witch is not necessarily, you know, a caricature of a Halloween type, you know, broom riding witch who is stealing children, or, you know, the pop culture sense.
But I guess a lot of that, a lot of those stereotypes and those tropes are intentional. Is that right? You know, the broom riding witch, the one who will steal children, and cause havoc. That seems to me to be an intentional practice of demonizing people.
Well, certainly it was in the past. If you think about fairy tales, you know, the grim fairy tales and witches, you know, practicing cannibalism and such, thinking of Hansel and Gretel just off the top of my head, which I do mention in the book. Yeah, sure. There has been that sort of, you know, from state and church way back when, this idea that, you know, if you're different, there's something wrong or bad or evil about you. And so they would create these stereotypes. I mean, the broom is symbolic to the witch. So, I mean, that's different. But, you know, other things that, you know, have been put out there as part of that fairy tale or folkloric horror, folkloric witchcraft or witches, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions about it that needed to be kind of pushed away, including like thoughts on magic or just, you know, occultism, or, you know, I even touch a little bit on Satanism. That's a whole other topic. But yeah, definitely. Of course, there's always bad propaganda from the ruling class.
Absolutely. It serves a purpose to perhaps reify positions of power and to reify authority and to continue to oppress and suppress the voices of marginalized folks, marginalized communities. And you give really solid dimension to those voices of the oppressed, culminating in something that I do want to speak a bit about later on, and that is the Burning Times, because that astounded me reading about that very
Yeah, well,
horrific chapter.
we can get into that like now if you wanted to, since we're in this topic. And I can say about, well, the Burning Times is a as a descriptive name for what happened to these people. That's a 20th century sort of invention, and the name is a bit contentious because of the fact with amongst historians, because it has been in some ways overinflated. Like, you know, to if you go online, there's like millions of people being murdered by the church, you know, as witches and whatnot, and that's inaccurate. But there is enough, and within church records, to say that yes, over centuries, you know, between 40 and 60,000 people at some point were tortured and murdered, either by church or by state, mostly in Europe, but also a little bit less in America, though, but it was there as well. So Europe, UK. And this is unfortunate. I'm sure that some of these people were actually practicing witchcraft. That doesn't excuse it or excuse the crimes that they were accused of. But we also have to remember that at the same time, you know, if you were Jewish or you were a Muslim or you were just somebody that the town village didn't like, so they would, or they wanted your land or whatever, they accuse you of, you know, giving the evil eye to their cow and spoiling their milk, and this could get you killed. So it was a horrendous period of time, and I do discuss one in particular, Gentile Budrioli, who was a middle-aged woman who was accused of all sorts of things, in a bit of a church conspiracy, I believe, in the 1400s here where I live, close to Bologna, Italy, where she was eventually, through torture, forced to confess to, you know, fornicating with devils and whatnots, and she was burned alive in the Piazza Maggiore in the square here in Bologna. So these things did happen, and they were horrifying. And I tried to shed some light on that because, yeah, these were marginalized people. If you didn't fit in with the status quo, or you were a bit strange or weird, or as I said, some of them probably were practicing witchcraft, you know, they were arrested and tortured, and under torture, you're going to confess to anything. So This is a chapter in my book in which I discuss it. I felt it was important to bring up the fact of the historical people that died in the name of witchcraft or strega, as it is known here in Italy. So I thought it was important to remind people that this happened, and unfairly so, because it continues to happen in many different other cultures and to many different peoples, people that are different. You know, they're to be despised and feared and harmed and put away. If you can't, you know, kill them, you're going to shove them off in a corner somewhere and not let them speak. So I thought it was important to give them a voice.
Absolutely. And, you know, as I said, the dimension that you provide to those histories and those stories, mm-hmm. and I would say in particular, the ones in Bologna, or Gentile, mm-hmm. the one that you were just speaking of, I believe that one did occur mm-hmm. in Bologna. Mm-hmm. When I was reading about some of your, perhaps your early experiences in Bologna, because of course you live there now, but you were born and raised in Toronto. I'm curious if you can take me through the process of discovery and learning some of these stories in Italy, in Northern Italy, some of these histories that, from my impression, seem to have been completely glossed over when you were doing your research.
They have been. I mean, obviously, like, there are witches here. There are people that are witches that have literature in that. But I mean, it is very difficult. Like, even with my husband, who, you know, went to university and lived the majority of his life in Bologna, had no idea that this was going on, or that, you know, because he's a scientist, so he wasn't focused on history. But it's not a history that is really taught. So you kind of have to go looking for it. And a lot of the records here, the church kept, there was a, especially in Florence and Bologna, there was a time frame, I think in the 18th century and 19th century, where the Vatican did try to, you know, cleanse the image of this by getting rid of a lot of these old documents that, you know, were like arrest warrants, and like they kept very, very good records. But there are other areas, like in Venezia, that or Venice, that the records were quite intact. So this is where we have scholars that were able to go in, even non-Catholic scholars that were given permission to go in and go through these ancient documents. So we've found out a lot more about the persecution of people, and what they were doing, and how they were trying to justify the, you know, torturing and killing people in the name that they were, you know, anti-church, or they were Satan worshiping, or they were, you know, witches. So, I mean, it was difficult. It's there, but you have to really look for it. You know, and there's books in Italian as well from scholars here that discuss it. Carlo Ginzburg is one who I mentioned in my book, who really did a lot of digging into the stories of these people. He's a Jewish scholar that was born in Bologna, and his interest as a historian began with trying to find out more about Jewish history in Bologna itself. And he kind of, through that, and through some synchronicity, started coming across a lot of witches. So from there, he kind of led him down the path of uncovering a lot of these different stories of people that had been arrested and murdered. And then other people who, interesting people like Minocchio, and that, who was a miller in northeastern Italy, who literally was talking about things that, you know, are just so amazing, because he was a miller. He shouldn't have had the ability to read. And yet he was talking about the cosmos and how there's no need for angels or a god, because if you look at the cheese, life, meaning maggots and things, springs forth from the cheese itself. So this is all natural. So you don't need this. Of course, when the church is hearing this, you know, supposedly illiterate man going and preaching this stuff, they're wondering, where's this coming from and why? But I mean, it's very interesting that just his being within nature and observing the natural processes and that of our planet and the cosmos itself inspired him enough that he was trying to explain or give a different interpretation than what, you know, the church was saying is the reason for creation. So yeah, but a lot of that came from Carlo Ginzburg, so I give him huge props for that. But in general, no, if you speak to the average person there, it's not something that's taught in school. It's not something that is, you know, looked upon. And in fact, in my book, I say how, like with John Paul II, he was trying to bring some reconciliation between Jewish people and Muslim people and that, and recognizing them as a viable religions that need to be respected. But he did leave out paganism. He did leave out Wicca, which Wicca is a it's a you know, accepted religion. So, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done, I think, in recognizing what happened in the past and kind of reconciling it and moving away from these things.
You hit the nail right on the head. So in Canada, as you know, there is a great deal of attention paid only recently to the horrors of residential schools and to the horrific crimes to missing and murdered Indigenous women, men, boys, and LGBTQ plus. All spectrum of Indigenous peoples are the subject of a history, a systemic history, and ongoing activities of colonialism. And there have been some efforts, definitely not led by the church, but led by Indigenous peoples themselves, to seek atonement from the church, apologies, reconciliation, and justice. Now, when I was reading Cosmic Witch, I was thinking, oh, I wonder if such a thing is possible with the church. But then I read just recently that Pope Francis, the so-called liberal pope, was perpetuating some of the harmful language about paganism.
Yes.
So where does that leave us when it comes to a discussion of reconciliation within Europe?
I think that I don't think that it's going to come anytime soon, because he is considered the most liberal of popes, and I don't see it. I think he is progressive in some areas, you know, like he is now saying that, oh, you know, maybe there are blessings to LGBTQ people, or their marriages should be okay, because I mean there are schisms within the church here as well. Like in Austria, for instance, there are clerics that are saying, no, we should be able to marry people. If people love each other, that's God's, that's up to God, not us. And I mean, and then, but there's the other side that's very, you know, angry and nasty. You know, as an example, Poland recently had an election. They brought in a very liberal government, a very progressive government. They were sworn in just 2 days ago, and there was a outgoing person who identifies as very conservative, very religious, Christian religious, and he took this opportunity to take a fire extinguisher and extinguish a menorah, because we are right now, as we're recording this, we're in the midst of Hanukkah. And his excuse, where he's, you know, and I mean, he's hitting children and everything with this fire extinguisher and putting out this menorah, which has been there for like you know, decades. And the rabbi was saying, we've never had a problem with this before. This is crazy. And he was more or less saying, well, you know, these people should be ashamed of the fact they're all satanic. And, what? And I'm like, this is the 21st century. So, I mean, like I said, there are parts of, I think that people that are, most Christians are good people. They're horrified. They're not going to, you know, be supportive of this kind of thing, but there is still these problems. And the church as an institution, even with this very liberal Pope, have stated that women have no right to be kind of in, you know, they're not their place. They don't put it exactly in that term. They try to make it sound nice, but it's really harmful, saying that women should be, you know, they can't be priests, you know, that they can't be religious leaders. They're, you know, still that patriarchy, right? So I think there's a long way to go. And I think people should just, we have to just move forward past these things, because none of this stuff is appropriate for the 21st century.
I was just going to say that that act against the menorah is not an outlier. So it's not somebody just off the street doing this. This is a person of power doing this.
This is an elected official. Okay. So there's still a long way to go, you know, as far as, like, you know, accepting of people, of marginalized people, and that includes women. You know, so I don't know, it's frustrating for me. I try to do the best I can and help where I can and stop and listen where I can. But it is very frustrating.
Well, absolutely. So the name of the podcast, Paranormal Matters, brings me to some of the, I guess, some of the elements of your book that have absolute depth and variety to them when it comes to exploring witchcraft in ways that I never would have imagined. And I've been reading a number of other books by probably some of your friends and some folks I'm getting to know as well, where once again, everything that I assumed about reality, everything that I've assumed about belief, everything I've assumed about myself is being called into question. And you place front and center of your narrative, beginning with yourself, a number of events that happened to you or that you were a participant in, beginning as a small child. And you, I think it was on page 17, you were talking about visiting a potential home that your family was going to purchase. And you are walking through a room that you wanted as your bedroom, and you see this small person standing in the room. And I read that and I was like, oh, I want to know more about that. So could you tell us about that incident and how that has stayed with you and how you've processed that?
Yeah, I'm just going to turn to that page because I do a quote of a nursery rhyme that I open that part up with. And it goes, last night I saw upon the stair a little man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. Oh, gee, I wish he'd go away. And I chose that because what you're talking about, that particular incident from childhood, was both baffling and frightening and was very difficult for me at that age to process, and still is somewhat. And I'll set the stage a little bit. My mother at the time, my parents, were having my younger sister, And so at the time we were living in a smaller, like two bedroom townhouse in Don Mills. And my parents decided they wanted to upgrade for their growing family. So they were looking at various different homes. And on this occasion, they brought me with them to this. It was like it was a new subdivision. So these homes, it's not like it was an older home with any history. So it was like a newer subdivision, and it was a model home. So we went in and they kind of let me have the run of things while like I was excited. And I mean, there wasn't anything for me to break or that there wasn't really any furniture in this place. It was a model home. Okay. So they let me run up and down the stairs and do things while they were talking to the realtor and checking out these places. And I was, of course, excited, thinking this is going to be my new space, my new home. And I went to the upstairs and there was a bedroom and it had a skylight. It was the only one with a skylight. And I remember that because I remember thinking, oh, this is so cool. And the roof was slanted and there's this skylight. And I'm like, oh, you know, like, what's this? And I went to turn around and go back because I wanted to find my parents and say, I love this place. This is going to be my bedroom. Yay. And I saw this man who really looked solid to me, like a little being, a little man, kind of maybe impish, but dressed normally. Like it was just his size and his look. And I looked at him and I thought, but you're not supposed to be here. You're like, who are you? And it was very, very strange for me. And I remember kind of like closing my eyes and kind of looking, and this man was there. And I could just tell he knew I was looking at him and he was looking at me, but I was too really afraid to say anything because something told me this isn't right. This isn't normal. And it just totally reoriented my feelings towards this place and this house. And what is this? And I went back. My parents were coming up the stairs and I met my mother, and she said she knew that something was wrong because all my demeanor had completely changed. I lost all the excitement and I was just kind of in shock. And I could see this man and I just kind of knew that no one else was seeing him, but I was. And I knew it was wrong and something was wrong. And I went on to have other experiences. I had strange experiences before that, but this one really stood out for me because I knew that it wasn't something good. It wasn't something of our reality. So I was trying to process that. And then, you know, you can't, you know that it's not something you can really talk about because, you know, if you try to, and I did over the years as a child, try to talk to friends and think, you know, they, if, unless you have an experience like this, you're pretty much laughed at. So it becomes very lonely because you're dealing with adults who are like, oh, that's nothing. Or you're not really seeing that, or it's your imagination. And you know it's not, because you have an imagination and you can make things up, but this is real, but it's not right. So I hope that I'm getting across that feeling to people about what it's like to have that kind of break with reality. And as a child, you don't know, and you don't know to question whether you're going crazy or not. And when you try to talk to adults or you try to talk to your friends, you get laughed at. So you learn to shut that in. And when you start seeing other things, like I would occasionally, after that point, start seeing these things in my bedroom, in my home. And it was very traumatizing because you can't really talk about it. And you can't, you know, you can cry out and people will say, well, this is a nightmare, even though you know you're wide awake. So that was what I consider my real initiation into the idea that reality is much more rich and complex than what we normally live in our day-to-day lives. And so I view that as the first initiation. And as initiations go, they tend to be painful. So it wasn't easy, and it's not something that I wanted to have. And as a kid, I thought, I guess because I was watching Scooby-Doo, and that this has to be a ghost. This is a ghost. That's what I thought that time.
So now I'm wondering if at the age that you are, would that be a general initiation into a reality of wonder, or is it something else?
It is a reality of wonder. It is a reality of imagination. I've talked to other people after The Cosmic Witch came out, and people as an adult that I've talked to that have had similar experiences, and they can get it. They also say, like, it is an opening of wonderment, that there is magic out there, but not always is it good, not always is it beneficial. I mean, but that reality is not always as we think it is. And part of magic, of course, is trying to game the system a little bit to have it work in our favor. And the possibilities that these things can happen, and that there are perhaps other beings and other things out there that are non-human that are sharing our space with us.
You know, before we started this, I was thinking to myself, why am I zeroing in so much on that account? And like you said, after your book came out, people were sharing similar stories. And it occurred to me, something similar happened to me. But one of those... Did you want to hear it?
Yes, of course.
So I'm going to explain it as I remember this happening. Okay. So we used to stay at my grandparents' house. Mm-hmm. And I stayed in one of the guest rooms. And each night I would wake up and there would be a little man and a little woman. Mm-hmm. And they seemed to be waxy or shiny. And they were in the room and they were just looking at me. How I remember this is that they were statues that my grandfather somehow got. I don't know from who or from. So for, I would say, for decades, I just always thought of these statues that my grandparents had. And when I was a kid and this would happen, these statues would look at me, or they would be in the room and I would feel like they're looking at me. I said to my grandpa one day, can you take these out of the room? Because it really is creeping me out, quite frankly, to have these statues looking at me. And he said, oh, okay, it's no problem. I'll put them up in the attic. And then that was the end of that. And there were no statues after that. But a few years after, I asked my grandpa, you know, when I was a teenager, I said, where are those statues that really creeped me out when I was a kid? I was probably like 3 or 4. I said, where did you put those statues? I want to see them because they were so, to me, they were really detailed in sort of old fashioned garb. And he looked at me and he said, what statues? And I said, the ones that I asked you to get out of the room because they creeped me out. And he said, I don't, there were no statues. So it's just one of those things where night after night, these things were in the room. But I think to process it, mm-hmm. right? Oh, they're statues. Mm-hmm. Can we please get rid of them? Because I don't like them. It looks like it feels like they're looking at me.
Well, yeah.
But it's an interesting thing that I did with my memory and that experience. And I asked my sister, do you remember those creepy statues? No, absolutely not. My grandmother, no, nobody remembers these statues that I apparently did. So,
wow. Yeah. Well, then no wonder you're relating to this little imp-like man, because it was similar. And he was staring.
Who knows, right? It's just, but you know, whether I don't know what to say to that, but it was just, it was a phenomenal experience that, to me at least, also is revealing about how we can compartmentalize and how we can put it in a nice little box and say, oh no, that didn't happen, or whatever it was that happened, it was something entirely rational, even though nobody else has a memory of it.
Exactly. And I do think that this happens with children. And I know there's a school of thought that says, like, you know, children are closer to the other side or to the veil, or however you would like to put it. And therefore, they're having these experiences more than adults. But what I think actually happens is that children are more likely to vocalize when they see something weird and outside of their consensus reality, that, hey, look at that, or hey. And then it's not until they're told, oh no, it's this, or it's something, statues or whatever, or we're going to put the statues away, that, you know, you kind of get that out of your mind, that it was something weird or strange. And adults do this naturally. Like, they'll see something weird and they'll immediately discount it, you know, as opposed to stopping and thinking, no, wait a second, now that was really weird. It's just, it's easier to go about our day-to-day lives. We got to get to work. We got to look after our kids. We got to do this. We got to do that. We don't have time for this weird stuff. Therefore, you know, you quickly rationalize it and move on. Whereas children will remember and they'll vocalize it. And it's not until adults start saying, well, no, that's your imagination, or you've had a nightmare, or that can't be that, you know, or don't make up stories or whatever, that, you know, children then learn to kind of keep these things to themselves. And in my case, and in many other people's cases that have these experiences with these little imp-like beings, and other strange things out there, or seeing our beloved dead or whatever, that it becomes a very lonely experience, because you can't, you learn not to vocalize it with other people. And yet it's still there and you can't explain it, other than what you're learning from horror movies, or, you know, or Grimm's fairy tales or whatever.
And I think it's very effectively educated out of us to appreciate the diversity of reality and consciousness, mm-hmm. as well, the mm-hmm. diverse forms of
Western culture. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no space for that. So, you know, mm-hmm. I think I was doing some developmental self-policing when it came to when it came to that particular event.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with me. That's just amazing. And see, we're not alone.
No, absolutely not. But on that topic, I guess, of policing and regulating our experiences and things that folks witness, you bring the readers through your experiences with UFOs, which is, to me, amazing. Again, you know, seeing lights that aren't easily explained in the sky. Now, this is a topic that it's on full spin cycle in the media at the moment, mm-hmm. and on the internet. And one mm-hmm. of the things that I can't help but notice is the physicality or the materiality of the subject of UFOs mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. always front and center. So whether that's a disclosure, whether that's evidence, whether that's the veracity of the subject, always focuses on whether it's real or not, right? Again, so going within exactly. the confines of what reality and what consciousness is, we have a very mm-hmm. narrow scope of how we engage with the subject, unless you're Susan Demeter, and you write a book called The Cosmic Witch. And you have this quote that I just want to lead into the question with. You write, quote, supernatural experiences are often very rich in symbolic content, much like our dreams. And I'm wondering if you can take us through the symbolic significance of your encounters with UFOs.
Okay. I would say that the first encounter with a UFO outside of childhood that I had when I was 23 with my brother-in-law at the time, we had been watching an Elvira Mistress of the Dark movie, and it was getting very late at night, and I had two very small children at the time, and I lived on a 10th floor condominium building with a glass sliding glass doors onto a terrace. And it was my habit to make sure before bed every night I made sure it was locked up just in case, because I had small children, so everything had to have the security locks on it. And I went and I realized it was getting late. It was getting to be about 1 o'clock in the morning. I have to be up early with kids. And I went to go and lock up those glass sliding glass doors. And I noticed this large red thing out through the window. And I'd never seen anything like it before. So it was November 4th. I was in my pajamas, but I went out onto this balcony. And you know, in Toronto, it's quite cold already in November. And I'm out there in my pajamas and I'm looking at this thing, which is out over the lake in the direction of the nuclear power plant. And it's an octagon red light, very octagonal in shape, that was pulsating. And I was looking at it and I was running down things in my mind thinking, what am I looking at here? Is this a plane? It can't be a plane. This is not a helicopter. It's not, there's no sound. But it's pulsing and it's pulsing. And it's like, I'm looking at it. And I called out to my brother-in-law. I said, you got to come out here and what is this? Okay, what am I seeing out of here? And he's looking at it. We're looking at it for a few more seconds there. And he grabs my arm and he said, I think we're seeing a UFO. And I'm like, oh, wow. And then at some point in my mind, the thought occurred that they can see us. They know we can see them. And I vocalized this, but I completely forgot about that until years later. But I said that to him and he acknowledged it years later. Yeah, you said that. I thought that was really weird. And we're looking at this thing, this red octagon, and it's pulsating. And then I see it kind of implode on itself and shoot straight up in the sky. And he kind of saw it just implode on itself and just vanish. So we had a little bit of difference there. And it was shocking. And we ended up staying all night talking and like, what is it? Like, what do you do with this? Like, who do you, like, this was pre-internet days. And at the time I looked in the next day in the morning papers, someone reported something. What is this? But the thing is that later on it took a few years after I tried writing. I went to the library. I wasn't really interested in UFOs. I had all these strange experiences, but I was more interested in ghosts and things like that than really UFOs. And so I had to go to the library and I took out some books and I found an address on the back of one for QFOS, which was Dr. J. Allen Hynek, Project Blue Book. It was a book and it had an address in Chicago. So I wrote everything out. This was a few weeks later and I stuck it in the mail. Unfortunately, it came back returned to sender. I hadn't known that Dr. Hynek had passed away a few years before. And I just kind of sat on that for a number of years. And it didn't really occur to me at the time, thinking about it, that the shape and the color of that UFO may have had some significance. In fact, it took many years after that I was thinking about this and meditating on it. And I thought, geez, that's a giant stop sign in the sky. And I'm seeing this and I'm seeing it over a nuclear plant. And I have to wonder, is there a correlation to this? You know, they do appear over nuclear plants. Is it trying to tell me something about the nuclear plant? Or is it trying to tell me something about my own personal situation in life? This giant stop sign in the sky. And going back into my personal life at the time, I was thinking maybe it's something personal for me. Maybe it's telling me I need to stop what I'm doing or to really stop and consider where I am in life, this sort of thing. So it takes on a more personal note then at that point than just maybe a machine in the sky that is hanging out over a nuclear plant doing things that physically are impossible. As far as like a plane or a helicopter or really any kind of aviation. I don't know.
No,
but there you go.
That is amazing. I think that one of the great values of your work is marginalized in sort of the UFO world.
Yeah, I'm a heretic amongst heretics like Jacques Vallée.
Oh my goodness. Well, it's to the point where, you know, so and so is saying this, and I can't even look because it follows the same pattern of, you know, as I said, focusing on the materiality of the matter, of the subject. And not going into, I guess, the archetypal significance, and you do mention Jung in Cosmic Witch, and a number of other authors are again, some of your friends and folks that I'm reading are talking about the symbolism and the deeply personal, but also in your case, that was a social event, so more than one person is witnessing
yes.
it. But interestingly enough, no two stories are alike in this particular case, and in many other cases as well. I think sometimes perhaps the differing nature of what people are reporting makes it very easy to discount, which is unfortunate, because perhaps, as you said, maybe there's something significant about that, a symbolic significance to each individual as they're having this shared experience. So
yes, it is. It's like, I do think that there are certain times that, you know, because you have a lot going on, and maybe something I need to do, like, I mean, a lot in the sense that there are a lot of UFO reports coming in all at once. So in the UFO world, it's considered a UFO flap or a UFO wave. The following day on November 5th, after my sighting, and I didn't learn this until years later, after the, you know, everyone started to get on the internet, there was a UFO sighting in Montreal the following night that was witnessed by at least 60 people on the top of a hotel. They was like a pre-Christmas type party or something of that nature, or going towards holiday parties. And only the people on the top of the hotel building actually saw this large disc-shaped, multicolored, lighted thing hovering over the hotel. People actually on the street and in buildings adjacent on this busy downtown Montreal street didn't see anything. So it was just like for these people. So there were a number of sightings in 1990 in Canada. There were certainly many, many sightings, thousands in Belgium and in Russia between 1989 and 1991. And in those cases, certainly you look at the geopolitical situation, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the breaking down of the Berlin Wall, and you have millions of Europeans and Russians who are going to be living in some state of anxiety with these major world changes going on. And you have UFOs all appearing in various shapes and sizes over NATO headquarters. That's got to mean something.
Absolutely. This is, again, I appreciate this level of discussion rather than sort of the wayward paths that I see, which actually brings me to my next question. And that is the theme of science and magic, or enchantment and disenchantment. And when I was reading your book, I was naively thinking, oh, you know, this is going to be highly critical of science. And I was entirely wrong, and gratefully so. And I just want to lead into a discussion with this quote that you have that upset my naive approach to what you were going to write about. So it's under the heading, A Word on Disenchantment. There is the popular notion that because science can help us to better understand our physical realm, it works towards disenchanting our world. I do not feel this has to be the case. Science, as I have outlined earlier, is simply a set of tools and explanations of our material realm. This does not necessarily mean we must negate the spiritual or that which is yet unexplained. In fact, science itself is often driven by a sense of enchantment. In other words, a sense of awe and beauty found within the material or natural world. An example of this would be the astronomers who are led to their study through a deep fascination and sense of wonder inspired by the stars. So what you do very nicely there is you say there's room for both, and perhaps both are not separate from each other.
Exactly.
And I haven't seen that done as effectively as you just did there, because I think my initial reaction is to take one side or the other, but not consider that there's actually a middle path here. And perhaps that's considering that both of these areas are actually closely linked to each other. So I just want to leave that open as an introduction to any thoughts that you might have that could add to that.
Sure. And I mean, like, and when it comes to certain scientists, Rupert Sheldrake is one. Jocelyn Bell Burnell is another who, in her case, she's deeply Christian, and she feels that her science, although like scientific methodology by its nature is going to have to be very rigid, okay, and in the material world. But for her, her discoveries, and she famously discovered pulsars when she was 19 years of age. She was still a student. Unfortunately, it was her professors that won the Nobel Prize. She made this discovery, which has really advanced our knowledge of the cosmos. But she has said, you know, as a Christian woman, she feels that her science has actually brought her closer to her God, brought her closer to her feelings of spirituality and faith. And I can appreciate that as a pagan, as an animist. I feel that the universe is fully alive. Our planet is alive. And I think that trying to understand it from that material point of view as well can help us. I mean, the scientific world has all sorts of problems of its own. But ideally, yes, like, you know, as a method, as an idea of wonderment, as to those questions of, you know, why is the sky blue? Why is the sun behave this way or that? Or, you know, these are things that start in wonderment and enchantment. Just being able to look out and think, wow, like, you know, are we really alone? Like, you know, just having a look at that bright night sky and seeing the stars, or being in the water and feeling it and wondering, you know, why is things certain way? Why are fish here? Why are, you know, these are all these questions that little kids ask, but that really ideally is what leads scientific inquiry is, you know, what can we learn? And sometimes with these great big breakthroughs, you know, it only leads to further questions and more, and we need to learn more, you know? So I don't see it necessarily as mutually exclusive, even in the ideas of consciousness and the conscious realm, because then we can start getting into like the quantum mechanics and stuff, which I certainly don't understand. I'm not a physicist, I think really only physicists understand this. And some of them say, I don't even understand all this quantum stuff. But in that mess of atoms and you know, all these things, you know, are, I think, are some answers that are out there. And I you know, unabashedly admit it's because I'm an animist, because I see a spark of consciousness in everything, in every aspect of our being and of the animals and the plants and our planets and the sun. And so maybe science needs to catch up.
And you know, I think there are some corners of the scientific world that would agree with you, but perhaps use different language, right? And that, I think that's perhaps where some of these camps develop, where sides develop. It's a semantic situation. But, you know, perhaps philosophy, art, physics, spirituality, there are these paths that don't necessarily separate each camp, but actually connect each camp.
Exactly. I think so. I'd like to think so. I'm a person that thinks in inclusivity, you know. I don't like seeing us versus them, or, you know, this camp is right or that, you know. I think that we're all on our path and that we all have something to bring to the table. So.
Absolutely. Well, I really appreciate your time today. You've been so kind and generous with your thoughts. And as I said, I think I mentioned to you before, I loved every word of The Cosmic Witch.
Thank you.
I really did. So it was such a treat to read. So what's next for Susan Demeter, The Cosmic Witch?
Okay, well, I'm writing an essay, as you know, on my experiences with haunted roads in Ontario, which has been a real treat for me to kind of go back in time and revisit a portion of my life where I'm spending a lot of time on haunted roads, and documenting and documenting other people's experiences as well. So I'm looking forward to that coming out. I am working on a joint book project with my husband, who is an astrophysicist, Massimo Teodorani. And we're writing on the afterlife and a possible physical explanation for afterlife. That again is very inclusive of pretty much everyone's spiritual paths. For the Cosmic Witch part, I will be working on a second book called Out of My Mind's Eye, which is the name of my website, where I will be talking about my own experiments, both with myself and with others in conjuring UFOs. So look forward to that.
Excellent. And your website is susandemeter.wordpress.com.
You can get to me by susandemeter.com or susandemeter@wordpress.com.
I will include a link in the description of this podcast. So, and also a link to The Cosmic Witch.
Thank you.
All right. And thank you so much for your time, Susan.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.